Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me in the studios is CBS Interactive, our guest for today, Kidsco's Paul Robinson.
Hi.
And Mediacom's Toby Jenner.
Hello there.
This week, another bad set of ratings for classic rock. A Death on Rafters delivers for Seven's ratings. Love Thy Neighbour, racist or reality? Telstra counts down to Christmas. Agency boss sued for misleading comments. And James Packer's secret weapon. But first we turn to our guests, Paul and Toby, helping me overcome the myth that everyone involved in Australian media is British. Maybe starting off with you, Paul. You're on your biannual visit to Australia.
My biannual visit, which I do love, actually. I must say, I've had a really interesting week, and it is just a week, but I managed to meet lots of people. And even though, you know, here people complain about the weather, for me this has been a really nice week.
And a happy anniversary to Kidsco as well. You've just hit your 1 year anniversary in Australia.
Yeah, one year on air on Foxtel and Austar on the 15th of November. So I've obviously been meeting with Kim Williams and John Porter and all those guys. But yeah, it's been a good start, good year. And really now the next stage is to do more investment in Australian production. So I've been meeting a lot of producers this week talking about potential projects and what we can do. And I think one of the things that quite excites them about what we do is, apart from the fact we can put the show on the air in Australia, but also we can export it to many of the 92 other countries in the world that we broadcast in.
Because it's English language, I suppose, if you
commission something. And we dub too. I mean, look, we've dubbed the Wiggles, for goodness sake. You know, we've dubbed the Wiggles into Spanish, German, Portuguese and French. So we can dub anything.
And what sort of projects are you looking at in terms of commissioning things?
Well, we're largely animation. You know, our positioning is boys and girls, 6 to 10, safe environment. So it needs to be something that fits those brand values. Good entertainment. Could be live action, but largely animation. Good storytelling. You know, hopefully something with heart, with a good purpose behind it. But it's got to be fun and entertaining and, you know, adventurous for kids. So we're pretty open, really.
Now, Toby, your family would kind of be target audience. Yeah, it was interesting that you weren't particularly aware of Kidsco at this stage.
Clearly a branding job to be done, I would have thought there, Paul. We're not, as a family, across it. I think for us, CBeebies, again, you can take the man out of London, but not the London out of the man, and moving away from the... And I'm delighted to hear what you're saying about fun with heart and safe environment, because I think that's a concern for a lot of parents, certainly of a kind of 6-4-year-old, to ensure that they are in that kind of safe, cosseted, cozy environment.
And non-advertising environment as well.
Less about the advertising, actually.
That's interesting, because when we launched Kidsco, Foxtel and Austar are very keen to have non-advertising options for parents who are concerned about it. And I think CBeebies is a great service, and obviously I know it from the UK and here, and they sort of sit below where we are in terms of age, and then we're the sort of the next channel along once they start growing out of CBeebies. Because the thing about kids is they do change very quickly, and they will grow out of that channel and they'll grow into ours, and then eventually they'll grow out of ours and they'll then be into Nickelodeon and Disney and all of that stuff, which maybe cause you more concern as a parent.
Well, I think they'll grow out of CBeebies into yours if they know about yours and they're talking about it in the playground. But I take the point about different channels for different ages. It's more about the content of the shows for me that the kids are talking about, rather than the content of the ads. As much as we'd like to think that it's all encompassing what we do, the kids in the playground aren't necessarily talking about the advertising, but they're talking about the shows.
But there's been big controversy this week, hasn't there, in the Australian press about Oreos, for example, and this whole issue about whether advertising's targeted at kids or at adults. So there clearly is concern amongst certain communities about advertising to children.
Yeah, that one, the Ad Standards Bureau, wasn't it? There were a couple. There's Oreos and there was Smarties.
That's right, yeah.
And both times it was almost two issues. Was the ad targeted at the kids in the first place in the way that it was created? And the other one was that they both had in common, and Toby, you might be able to just explain how these things work, is it looked like in both times where they fell foul was because it ended up on kids' programme where they were bonus slots or make goods. So the original media plan was for more adult-targeted or family-targeted programmes, but not primarily kids. But they then ended up on things like Dora the Explorer or whatever. Or that was at least the excuse that the agencies gave.
Yeah.
Is that credible? Is that how it kind of works?
Give them the benefit of the doubt. I think it could be credible. I think there are a number of advertisers who do this very well and have very clear guidelines self-imposed before we start to have things imposed on us. Coke's a great example where the advertising, they can't, I think I'm right in saying, advertise to any show that has over 50% content of audience that is under the age of 12. And I would think any responsible marketeer and brand would do similar type or have a similar type approach to that. Certainly, you know, we're talking to an advertiser at the moment about their brands, and you know, they can't talk to anyone with children under a certain age. So, you know, we really do start to refine the legislation accordingly. So, is it credible that Oreos was advertised and had legislation like that self-imposed? Yes. Could they have put the advertising elsewhere? Yes, absolutely.
And do you find, for instance, that, you know, with your arrangements, for instance, you would say firmly to the media owners, actually, do not give us bonus slots in these programmes as well, so that they can't accidentally slip in? Would you go as far as that, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. I would hope that we as a business are across where our clients' airtime is being placed, whether it's bonus or whether we're paying for it, and ensure that we know if it's going into X, Y, and Z day part or channel. I mean, I'd be horrified to think that bonus just gets placed randomly without us being across it.
Okay, well, Paul, I guess one of the advantages you've got over us is you're actually seeing a lot of markets around the world at the moment. What certainly the kind of perception is here in Australia, we're having things pretty good in terms of the media economy. What's your impression on how things are in the rest of the world at the moment?
I think it's patchy. You know, I agree. I think Australia's had, you know, some dip, but overall, you know, if you look at your performance over the last few years, Australia's done pretty well and better than most. Southeast Asia is generally very buoyant. You know, they're coming from a lower base, but the growth rates in their economies are impressive and in some cases double digits. Central Eastern Europe is still very much an emerging market, but growing very fast. It's really Western Europe which is sluggish. You know, UK is just coming out, but we've had big rainbacks in government expenditure, and we've yet to see the impact that's going to have on consumer spending and advertising. In Spain, they've still got severe problems with high unemployment. You know, France, Germany, you know, coming out of it but sluggish. So I think the great thing for us about, you know, serving such a large number of countries across such a great wealth of territories is you can play swings and roundabouts on it. You know, there's upside some places and downside in other places. So as a business, you know, we're doing fine and we're actually ahead of plan, but, you know, some markets are below and some are above.
Now, Toby, you're part of WPP, which is Europe-based. Does that actually impact
on... Well, it's global,
on,
Tim.
Yes, it's. I was going to say it's based in London, but then I had a feeling there was some sort of tax dodge that involved you being in Ireland now officially. So.
Well, we're listed on both the UK and the US Stock Exchange.
And from your point of view as a CEO here in Australia, are you affected by what's going on in London, for instance, because of where the centre of gravity of the company is?
Well, I'll come to that. I'm interested about the government expenditure because this time last year it was fated as the biggest ever media win, which WPP Group M consolidated. And this year it's a £40 million advertiser from £240 million worth of advertising. So, yeah, absolutely, to Paul's point, it's been cut dramatically. And I think that austerity is something that's flowing through the whole of the UK economy. Although if you have kept your job, interest rates are fairly healthy and restaurants are fairly full.
Well, I mean, yeah, exactly. If you go around, you know, Soho, I mean, all the restaurants are full. You can't get a table. The bars are rocking at night. There's no obvious sign of it. But I think, you know, we are going to see cuts in public jobs.
Yeah. Toby, how
so, sorry, just so back to your question on WPP. Does it impact us? I think it's easier in at the height of the global financial crisis for a business to pull the shutters down globally. And immediately than it is to say, well, do you know what, Australia's performing okay, the UK is really hitting the depths, we'll chop there. So that was how we managed our way through it. So yeah, it impacts globally, but it was always thus, you know, if you are part of a global network, there are upsides and there are downsides.
Another set of results that or quarterly updates that came out this week, in fact, I just saw this shortly before we came in the podcast, is update from News Corp, which is looking pretty good. among the things they said was that publishing has bounced right back, and this is globally in the UK as well. And the one bit that's lagging still is their digital stuff. They're still losing a massive amount of money from MySpace, to the extent that there were some pretty serious comments from the chief operating officer that seemed to be hinting that News Corp is running out of patience with MySpace, that this won't go. They described that they weren't willing to sustain the losses. Toby, do you see MySpace as a serious player in this market, a serious challenger for advertising dollars, for instance?
It's a channel like any other channel. Does it grab my attention as much as Google? No. You know, is it on my radar as much as the vast majority of media channels out there? Not really. Is it necessarily as well packaged and sold with everything else that news have? I'm not sure. I'm probably not the best person to ask that. But certainly if I was selling it, it would be pulled in within the overall component of the News Limited pitch.
Paul?
I think, you know, their digital strategy is still very much up in the air, isn't it? They've put paywalls up on all sorts of products. And, you know, I guess the question is it too much too late? The problem with digital and internet-delivered products particularly is public expectation is they are free at point of use. And therefore, if they're not ad-supported, I think you have a problem convincing people. Certainly, since they put paywalls up at the Times in the UK, the number of people accessing the service has plummeted.
It's halved.
So, you know, I think there's a big question about whether paywalls work and whether that digital strategy is the right strategy. And you know, I applaud what they're trying to do, but I think the jury's still out.
Mm. Toby, Mediacom's year. What sort of year has it been?
It's been a very good year for us, Tim. We haven't lost any business. We've won over $125 million worth of business with clients such as Blackmores, IAG, Yum, and the like. And we have won lots of awards. I mean, we're the most shortlisted agency. And we set ourselves a challenge this time last year to be the most shortlisted, or to be recognised for creating and delivering great communication solutions, was the very verbose way of saying it. But, you know, to get up there and do some great work.
So how long have you been here now?
Two and a bit years.
It's that long, isn't
it? Two and a half years.
See, I remember when you arrived, and for externally, not much seemed to happen at first. Like, from when you were looking from outside, obviously when you first arrived, Annie Parsons was still at the... Was she chairman then?
Or CEO.
Yeah. How would you describe the culture of the agency now compared to, say, 18 months or 2 years ago? You know, how has it changed under your command?
Well, not just my command, but, you know, myself, Mark Pedgick, and a number of the senior management team, I think it's changed dramatically. We are a business that, when you say not a lot happened outside, externally, that may be the case, but what we were actually doing was bringing in a lot of talent to be ready for a time that we could start making changes. And we now have a vibrant culture. Our churn is half the industry average. So the industry average for 6 months of this year was 37%, as measured by the Media Federation, which I think is just the single biggest challenge we as an industry face. And we have vacancy rates in our industry of 7%. You know, it's not something that I've ever encountered from my time over in the UK. And we've spent a lot of time ensuring that, you know, we are a stickier agency to work at. And this year, you know, I'm delighted. I'm still slightly horrified by it being 18%, but delighted that it is 50% below the average. And that's just the average.
And I guess the most recent big hiring you made is Paul Payne.
Yeah, Payne joins us early part of 2011, so delighted to have him on board, and he'll be great.
So he is in a strategy role. He's coming across from OMD. What are his kind of credentials? What made you go for him? For
maturity. I think he's a bright, articulate, mature, collaborative leader of people. I think he'll inspire the guys. He does his psychology a day a week, which I think will be hugely beneficial to us as a broader business.
Internally or for the clients?
Both. I think, you know, people having great experiences and areas of interest outside of work that they can bring back into work is something that will be hugely beneficial for all parties.
And Payne was obviously replacing a pretty big character in Matt Baxter, mm-hmm. who's hasn't started yet, but is going across to UM.
Yeah.
Presumably you were sorry to lose Matt after, I guess, only a year or so.
Matt was with us 18 months. So there's various phases in agencies, isn't there? The storming, norming, and the performing that people talk about. And Matt was perfect for the storming phase. and I think Payne will be great for the norming and the performing bit.
OK, well, next up we talk some more bad news for classic rock. So this week the radio ratings were out, seventh set of the year, I think it was. Now, classic rock just doesn't seem to be budging at the moment, up from 2.7% to 2.8% share in Sydney, down from 3.4% to 3.2% in Melbourne. Now, this is, I guess it's probably been about 6 months since Vega rebranded as classic rock, which was DMG. Puts it in the same sort of space as Triple M in that sort of, you know, that rock format. Now, Paul, in a previous existence, you've got a lot of radio experience. Firstly, the format of classic rock with a lowercase c and lowercase r is still a viable format, do you think, kind of globally?
Classic rock is one of those formats that actually promises a huge amount and doesn't always seem to deliver, not just in this market but in other markets. US is possibly the one exception, but in the UK, you know, classic rock has not really cut through as a format with significant market shares. I don't know this station particularly, these two stations particularly well, and haven't listened to them a great deal, so I can't really comment on how well they're executing the format. But what I would say about radio is it's very hard to make quick gains in a radio market. You know, what tends to happen is you tend to drip away ratings slowly, or you tend to make gains over a slow period of time. So it might be it's too early to call. Because, you know, you've got a number of big players in both Sydney and the Melbourne market who are clearly getting stronger. And there's only so many, you know, hours of listening to go round. And if these guys are just doing a mediocre or average job, they're just not going to pull in the ratings. So, you know, they've either got to have a big personality maybe at breakfast. And it seems in Sydney and Melbourne that the breakfast shows are still the key drivers of those ratings, looking at those numbers. Or maybe they're just not doing it well enough.
And that's one of the issues, I think, with classic rock is they took the decision to very quickly, when they moved from Vega to classic rock, they dropped the Sydney breakfast for show. They stuck with it a little longer in Melbourne, but haven't yet kind of replaced a sort of personality breakfast. You've also, as you say, with breakfast, you've got Kyle and Jackie O still dominating on Today FM in Sydney, despite the fact that you've got Kyle going off sick, also trying to do the X Factor as well.
You see, the other problem is I think people often make the mistake of thinking that a music format alone will get you an audience. Now, the trouble is there's other ways of getting a great music format, you know, the iPod being the obvious one. So if all you're doing is just playing a bunch of great records, it's probably not enough to make people switch their habits. You know, radio is about personalities, and you will listen for a really fantastic personality. And if they haven't got one, they're probably missing a trick.
Now, Toby, the declaration of interest is until relatively recently your agency worked with DMG. I won't ask you to go too much into detail about the DMG stations, but what do you see? Which of the networks do you see as kind of having momentum in the market at the moment?
I'll just take a step back, and I would like to make one comment about DMG, because I do think that you said Vega rebranded to Classic Rock, and I'm not sure it did, actually.
Well, I think switched off. And
yeah, I think exactly that. I think what it did was it switched off one day and switched on the other with a new name. And maybe a new format, and that's not rebranding. That's just confusing your customer, and they haven't actually. It felt more like a holding pattern before maybe they rebrand to something, but certainly I don't see that as a long-term gain. Well, look, I mean, I love Oz Stereo. I mean, I think Hamish and Andy are quite simply stand out. Carl winds me up. I find it mystifying how he's got no charm. And I find it mystifying how he does so well. I cannot genuinely work it out in my brain that someone who's so relatively offensive without any charm and yet recovers time after time after time having offended people. Whereas Hamish and Andy, I think, are quite simply, whether it's on television or on radio, the standout talent. And I just see very long, successful careers. And being relatively new to the market and mystified to hear that they were on TV previously, and it didn't work because I just think they're fantastic. I mean, coming from the UK, very, very similar to a couple of Geordie lads called Ant and Dec.
And Hamish and Andy, of course, at the moment they've got the drive time, national drive time slot on Austereo, going to one day a week so they can pursue the TV careers again at the end of the year. And I think Hamish and Andy get aired in the UK on Verge, on Absolute Radio, actually.
On Absolute Radio, they get once a week, yeah. I mean, Absolute Radio is an interesting story too, because it was Virgin Radio. And when they dropped the Virgin name and moved to Absolute, they lost half the audience. And they've still struggled to actually, you know, get the numbers back.
And Virgin was on a kind of rock format, wasn't it?
It's sort of a rock format. I mean, not classic rock, but it's sort of playing modern rock with some classic rock. And, you know, I think I know a little bit about radio. If I listen to Absolute now, I think it's a better station than Virgin was. But it's not getting the numbers.
And of course, at one stage, the boss of the programming boss of Virgin was one Paul Jackson.
Was Paul Jackson, who's now coming here.
Who's now headed in this direction to head up programming at DMG. And I wonder if that goes to what Toby was saying about there's a bit of a holding pattern until he kind of arrives. What can you tell us about Paul Jackson? What are his talents? What are his strengths?
Well, Paul Jackson, of course, is Richard Park's son. And Richard Park is one of the legendary names in UK commercial radio, who started at Radio Clyde as a presenter and a football commentator, and then went to Capital Radio. And Capital had a sort of pretty rough period when they had a lady there who was actually the former editor of Women's Own, who turned it into sort of a mushy, sort of middle-of-the-road, you know, nothing station. And Richard sort of rocked it up.
Was this Linda Smith?
No, it wasn't Linda Smith. She was the commercial editor. And it was actually a lady called Jo Sandilands, who just didn't understand what a radio station was
like.
No
relation to Carl Sandilands, I presume.
I don't think so. But he sort of rocked it up, you know, Capital 95.8, you know, music power, and then Capital became very successful. Richard is now the head of broadcasting at Global, which is the largest single commercial group in the UK, and they've basically bought up, you know, half of the UK commercial industry. So Paul is his son. So he comes from a fantastic pedigree. You know, Paul's worked at Capital, he's worked at Virgin. He understands talent. He understands how to get the best out of talent. I think he understands music policy. He understands how to position stations in the market. You know, you've got to have something unique and stand for something. And I think he gets all of that. Be a big learning curve for him in terms of understanding this market compared to the UK. But he's got all the basic skills. And I think given time, he could make an impact.
Good stuff. Well, next we talk content. So the Australian Subscription Television and Radio Association, otherwise known as ASTRA, has announced the theme for next year's conference, which is Content Matters, which I guess, Paul, is reassuring to hear that.
Well, it reminds me a bit of Mark Thompson, the Director General of the BBC, who recently said putting quality first. I mean, if you're a public service broadcaster, what else would you do? It's somewhat apple pie, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose so. And I guess, in fairness, what they're kind of saying is, okay, the focus of the conference is going to be talking about the programming as opposed to, you know, the business side of it.
Well, I think the key point for subscription television in the UK or in Australia or pay TV is, you know, it's at 34% or so, and it's really not as far forward as it should be for a developed country like Australia. And that's because of a number of different things, one of which is you've got to make sure, if you're going to ask people to pay for TV, there's something on there they really want. And that's got to be about great content. And it can't just be about sport. And sports here is difficult because of the anti-siphoning rules. It can't just be about movies. There's got to be a lot more. So I think what they're saying here is focusing on what is it about pay TV, subscription TV, in content terms that makes it compelling, that will encourage you to pay for it as opposed to watch a free-to-air network.
Yeah, I think in part you're right. I'll just add to it that I think it's more ground in the legislation that we have over here. Siphoning, yes, but equally the Telstra, Murdoch and Packer component of ownership of Foxtel. And, you know, if we could somehow get one of them, Murdoch obviously has the greatest pedigree in this space, to just take it by the scruff of the neck, own it and run with it as he's done with Sky in the UK, I think we'd see an infinitely stronger and more viable growth opportunity around it.
Well, part of the problem too, though, in this market, I think that's right, but also the legislation in this market is incredibly behind the times. You know, the regulators don't really get where we're going with, you know, the future world. And it's very much favouring free-to-air networks, you know, in a way that really is quite crazy. I mean, it's only probably, you know, it's not quite as bad as Italy. But, I mean, you know, Italy aside, it's probably the toughest market for a pay business to really make traction because of the regulation. So, you know, the government and the regulators have got to wake up, because they're really not helping the pay industry in this country.
I wonder as well whether one of the differences, even if the, and obviously, you know, as you'll know, the siphoning rules are, we could hear some new proposals any day now. One of the things that drove the success for News Corp in the UK with BSkyB was Premiership football. Whereas here, we don't have a single dominant code. So I just wonder that even if siphoning comes along, there's not a single card you can play, and that's it. You've got an audience. You look like you maybe disagree on that one, Toby.
Look, I think the Premier League made a big difference, and it was a huge success for both Sky and the Premier League, it has to be said, because football was dying a horrible death in the late 80s. I think there are more opportunities beyond just the content that you see on Foxtel. Look at what Sky have done. And there was a wonderful radio interview in part with Murdoch on, I think it may have been Tuesday night on the ABC, which I happened to stumble across, about him trying to buy back the remaining ownership of Sky in the UK. But in the UK, they've got broadband, they've got phone, they've got mobile, and they have television. You know, they've got that quadruple play offer to the market, and that's something that I think adds value. And I think it'd be something that would be competitive to Telstra. I mean, it's very easy to Telstra bash. You know, in fact, if you type into Google Telstra is, it predictive text comes up crap, which gives you an indication.
I think it was me. I just put that in a lot.
But. I think it's more than just you. And for me, I think that's indicative that we talk about competition. You know, I'd like to see competition in that space more than any other space. You know, I go mad the fact that I cannot come the end of the month, and thank God it's the fourth today because it's the new month of my Telstra bill, and therefore my computer actually works and the broadband comes through. But the 3rd of November, it's as slow as
you get the shaping, don't you? Oh, yes.
I think you're totally right. I mean, the content is important. It's not the whole story. You know, the things you just mentioned are absolutely right. You know, I mean, if you've got a PVR, for example, that fundamentally changes how you view television, you know. And if you've got, you know, non-linear services, I mean, consumers are going to actually want now to increasingly watch things when they want to watch them. You know, they're not going to be tolerant of schedulers just saying it's going to be on this time. So all these other services you've talked about, I totally agree. You know, put those together and you have a compelling proposition, just as this conference is talking about content, and that's their proposition.
Yeah, I mean, content, you know, when wasn't it important?
And I suppose the other question when we're talking about the sort of the growth of pay TV or the slowing down growth is, finally, Freeview has sort of got a bit of momentum this year as well. Are you finding the way that you plan media schedules has changed now that we've got the likes of 7-2, Go, Gem, Mate, etc.? Is that actually changing the way that you do business in free TV?
Yes, it is. So I'm hesitating because I'm thinking about more broadly our business and how it's changing the shape of our business. It's allowing us... The point about content is it's bloody expensive to produce, and I'm sure you'd contest that. So what it's giving us an opportunity is, with the money that we've got through our clients, is saying to them, well, look, you know, do you want to be in shows like this? Do you want your programme integrated with this client? Or, you know, we've just done Don't Stop Believing, which was a fabulously successful format in the UK. And group
Come
M.
on, it wasn't fabulously successful at all.
Well, it's
it
a show
down
that,
the ratings, didn't it? It got moved out of prime time.
It's a show that was launched and got prime time coverage. And, you know, Group M were exec producers.
It's a shame it's on Channel 5, really.
Yes, not the most successful channel. But equally, we look at China's Got Talent and what P&G are doing with that. And I think... So that's one half of it. And I think the advent of the free-to-air terrestrial stations, it gives us more opportunity to do more interesting stuff. You know, I wouldn't dream of going to Tim Warner at 7, for example, and saying, I've got a great format for you in prime time 7. You know, it'd show me the door, and rightly so. But I think there are opportunities on 7, Mate, and the likes of Gem to do more interesting stuff. From a planning buying perspective, of course it impacts and of course it changes, because you've got that narrow cast depth of consumer that you can target, whilst you've got the broadcast message of the free to terrestrial main stations.
Well, next, there's nothing like good old tragedy to deliver TV ratings. So Tuesday night saw that rarest thing these days, a TV show delivering more than 2 million viewers. This was packed to the rafters, the very mysterious who was going to die. It was kind of almost, we were having the conversation in my office where I realised just how old I was when people looked at me blankly when I talked about who shot JR and had to explain to Georgina, who's sitting here doing doing the production, what Dallas was as a programme, as it kind of dawned on me JR was shot before she was born. But Toby, this was Tuesday night. Now, were you celebrating the Melbourne Cup, or were you watching Mel Rafter's death?
I was doing neither, actually. I certainly wasn't celebrating the Melbourne Cup because of Pedge's awful tips that he gave me. So I lost on the Melbourne Cup, and I was probably at home catching up with my wife and family, having been away last week. But no, I didn't see it. But I think, you know, it's phenomenal. Everyone loves a good cliffhanger. And I, like you, can remember JR being shot by Kristen.
I think that's right.
That is correct. Yeah,
that's not a bad
it is Kristen.
Yeah. I'm just amazed nowadays with all the social components that we have exposure to, that they can keep something like this quiet and it doesn't get out.
That was the thing. They managed to keep the secret, didn't they? They actually...
Which is fantastic.
Yeah, which is pretty unusual. Now, one other thing that I sort of noticed from that day was how the Australian version of Top Gear, and excuse my shuffling as I tried to find the ratings, really didn't rate that well at all. And it was another Shane Warne episode of which it often seems to be, and I think there's this theory that the Australian viewing public loves Shane Warne. But this is the third episode of Top Gear, the Australian Top Gear, the second time he's popped up, and it was low. It was below a million, if I remember rightly. Do you get the sense that Australian Top Gear is going to be a kind of viable franchise, for instance, Toby?
If you didn't have the UK Top Gear, would we be having this conversation? I guess is inherent in the answer to that. You know, is a million good for a show like Top Gear, or is it just versus the success of Clarkson and May and Hamster?
I think it's a really good question. Just on the Melbourne Cup for a second, I had a client in that evening, so I was walking back down George Street about 11 o'clock, having said goodbye to my clients. I couldn't believe how many people were staggering around the place. I mean, they'd obviously been drinking since lunchtime, and the whole town was drunk. I think I was the only person who was sober. It was so funny, you know, when you see drunk people and you're sober, it really is quite amusing, isn't it?
I think it is. Do you know, it's a British thing as well as you arrive. I remember when I arrived in this country 4 years ago, about a week or two I'd been here when Melbourne Cup came along, and it was... About lunchtime, you saw these people going out. I think, oh, they must be going off to a wedding or something. Don't they look nice? And then I swear I stepped over the same woman lying in the gutter later
on. You know. No, out to lunch, don't come back. I mean, I watched it on TV and then got back to my work. Just on this format thing, I think what's really interesting for me, having watched Australian television this week as someone from outside, is how some formats are done so brilliantly and some are done so badly. Now, you know, MasterChef, clearly the winner. And I watched Junior MasterChef and I thought, wow, that's just fantastic. You know, I mean, it was just compelling television. The best sort of reality television there is. And then on the other hand, I watched Deal or No Deal, which was utter crap. You know, there's no tension. It's just the presenter is all about him. He gets nothing out of the contestants. There's no real sense of jeopardy. And I thought it just ruins what is otherwise a brilliant format. So I think, you know, on the issue of Top Gear, I totally agree with what was just being said. But, you know, you can either get it right and get it wrong. And that's a very glib thing to say. But actually, the format itself does not necessarily mean it's a guaranteed success. Execution is really important.
And it's interesting you mentioned Deal or No Deal, because there was a point at which it was generally narrowly beating Hot Seat, which is sort of Eddie Maguire's sort of cut down version of Millionaire. But pretty much consistently for the last certainly 4 or 5 months or so, Hot Seat's been coming out ahead, which does suggest that maybe Deal or No Deal has lost its way.
Oh, that host, I'd shoot him. He irritates me to death.
Andrew O'Keefe, I find him quite likable, actually.
Oh, really? Okay.
Doesn't that come back to your point that you made earlier about the radio? Is it's about the personality and it's about the talent. And if you've got decent talent, I'm not necessarily putting Noel Edmonds in that category, but if you have got decent talent and leader of the show, then it tends to work better than if you don't.
That's exactly.
Well, next we talk Telstra counts down to Christmas already. So Telstra, who we've already talked about today, has already launched its Christmas campaign with 55 quirky deals. Now, this is like... I'm fully aware I sound like a complete old curmudgeon, particularly when I say that I was in the supermarket last night and they've started playing the Christmas carols, which just I kind of struggled with sort of early in November. But this big idea for Telstra is they're going to do this huge campaign, 55 Days of Christmas. So they've started already. Now, one thing that they did this week was they did some quite nice experiential stuff where they kind of did, some amazing kind of light projections on Customs House in Sydney and at Town Hall in Brisbane and at Federation Square in Melbourne. And I watched the video of that just before we came in here, and it looked great. And, you know, effectively turned each building into a giant advent calendar. But the problem I have is... Day two, the pop-up behind the calendar was a free PDF of, it was called the Leftovers Cookbook, but when you downloaded the PDF, it was two recipes. The first one was how to make a turkey sandwich. Now, this was the 2nd of November gift. Is someone honestly gonna keep a PDF for 2 months explaining how to make a sandwich? And I always feel like there's a strategy I'm missing. I mean, my first thought was... it was a joke or something, but it doesn't seem to be. Toby, you know strategy stuff better than me. What's going on there?
Yeah, I share your Ebenezer Scrooge approach to Christmas starting in November. Although I have to say, I was in DJ's in Newcastle, where my father-in-law lives, in, I think, August. And I seem to remember a small corner of Christmas stuff already out on display. So, you know, it goes from the sublime to the ridiculous. Look, I think the idea's not a bad one. I think the advent calendar, 55 days, is a kind of thread of steel that I always like to see in strategies. I think the challenge is, A, how you keep that momentum going over such a long period of time without people just being bored, quite frankly. And clearly that specific example you've just given, and I'm not across the detail like you, Tim, but that specific example you've just given, it feels like it should be an advent calendar for the 25th, 26th, or 24th, 23rd. Clearly they'll be building up to some big aha. But as I say, you know, making sure that they get the consumers to that point will be somewhat of a challenge, because clearly you're sounding bored of it after 48 hours.
And I feel bad because I always knock Telstra all the time.
Nothing wrong with that, Tim.
Well, I think, and you know, I've said this before, the difficulty they have as a company is just because everyone in Australia has experienced their customer service, and it's actually really hard to write about their marketing and give it a fair crack when, as a customer, you loathe the service that you've kind of received from them.
Absolutely, and I think that's inherent in their challenge. You know, they should take $10 million out of their marketing expenditure. You wouldn't even notice the difference, and they should put it into their call service and get that up to scratch, because that impacts much more than seeing some bloke in a van wandering around the Big Banana.
That was exactly my reaction. I mean, everywhere I go, people complain about Telstra. And, you know, there is no one who says anything else. I mean, everyone moans about it and talks about crap customer service. Now, I mean, I share again the Ebenezer Scrooge 55 days. I mean, this is going to go until January. I mean, it's not even going to go till Christmas. It's going to go way beyond Christmas. And I don't know about you, but by about 27th of December, I'm actually looking forward to the new year. And I want to, you know, love Christmas. Love it. Great family time. But by 27th, I've had enough. I don't want to be doing 55 days of Christmas on the 5th of January. And these guys will be. So we're going to lose interest very quickly. But honestly, I totally agree. Focus on the product. Focus on the customer service. Not some crappy marketing campaign. Just get on and improve your service. There's so many fundamentals to address. That's where the effort should go, and that's where the budget should go.
And I suppose that more widely on Christmas, Toby, it, in terms of any kind of retail clients, it's actually a massively busy time, isn't it? So presumably you must have your kind of a lot of the Christmas media planning already kind of nailed down.
Yeah, pretty much locked and loaded. I mean, we start Christmas planning kind of 6 months out, so mid-year. For most of our clients, you know, and there are clients that are more predisposed to the season of summer, such as, you know, Carlton United Breweries and the like. So we're in a good place there, and we're already looking at, you know, January, February now.
And do you have to keep people sort of on actually in the office over that Christmas New Year period for tactical stuff, or does the agency mostly sort of able to shut its doors?
Well, I think the agency mostly will shut its doors. There will always be skeleton staff, and you know the great thing about mobile phones is we're always contactable, which I will ensure I am. But you know, on the whole, I want everyone. I've already had my Christmas and Australia Day ruined last year on that basis. So on the whole, we'll shut down skeleton staff, but they'll be compensated with holiday subsequently if they're in over that Christmas period.
Now, briefly, because we are almost running out of time, we'll next be talking about an expensive day in court for Lo Hunt. So advertising agency Lo Hunt will fork out $300,000 after losing a legal battle against former employee Andrew Moss, who successfully sued, arguing that he was, when he was recruited, he was given an overly rosy view of the agency's situation. Now, this is one we should be careful talking about the specifics of that particular case, but what reading the court documents, which I do recommend to anyone, go and find the story on Umbrella and have a read, because they're a very intriguing read if you follow the link through. But one of the things that it did kind of bring across, Toby, is that difficulties for a CEO who you're trying to recruit key talent, nothing is ever perfect. And the temptation is to talk things up, but this obviously in this this case the court ruled that it went beyond what was acceptable in talking it up. But how do you kind of approach that sort of recruitment process? Because you know you want to persuade people you're worth joining.
Yeah, of course you do. I have a bit of sympathy because to your point, you do want to talk it up. I think you sell the dream. You know, as you say, you can always be better. And I think that restlessness is what makes successful businesses, not just media agencies. But you have to sell the dream. You have to sell where you're going. You have to sell the vision. You have to sell how you're going to get there if you haven't got the component parts of the business in place. And, you know, that's what, to be fair, that's what we've had to do. I think now we can actually talk and reflect on a number of areas that are cast in stone and where we've had success. But prior to that, you have to sell a vision and the dream.
Paul, have you ever told a porky when you're recruiting?
I haven't told a porky, but I mean, sometimes you might leave out things which are necessarily not as positive as others. I mean, I think I agree. You've got to get people inspired and you've got to get them passionate about wanting to join you, you know, buying into your vision and wanting to be part of that team that's going to strive whatever you're striving for. So in so doing, you clearly talk up, you know, the challenges as well as the successes. You know, I think disclosing detailed financial information, you may not necessarily do that, but I think it's about leaving something out is different to actually telling something that's untruthful. And I would never say anything untruthful. I wouldn't necessarily disclose all the confidential information. I think in this case, the guy clearly went too far.
Next, James Packer's secret weapon. Well, it's been a fortnight since the last podcast, as we were in Melbourne for the Mumbrella question time last week. But we can't let the time go by without at least briefly talking about James Packer's investment in Ten. He took nearly 20%, which it's since emerged. It looks like he's going to be perhaps sharing with Lachlan Murdoch. What was your reaction, Toby, when you heard this new investment?
I think it's quite exciting. I unfortunately wasn't here in the days of Packer, but the legacy lives on. I find it slightly mystifying that, you know, a guy who passed away, you know, 7-8 years ago is still so preeminent in his stature in the, you know, the advertising marketplace. You know, I used to come and stay in Australia. I'm married to an Aussie and have breakfast at a place called the Cosmopolitan in Double Bay, where I sat at the front with all my mates, and one day we went downstairs and said, I would like to sit on our normal table, and he said, no, not today. And I subsequently found out that Packer went there every Saturday morning with his mates after they played tennis and sat there. But it was a wonderful sort of anthropological watch of society and him and his mates and people being wheeled in and then wheeled out and put to the end of the table. And it was just fascinating. And, you know, that I think that for me sums up what I've maybe missed out on. So I think any kind of involvement of James or Lachlan's a good thing. You know, they've got good pedigree that you were talking about earlier with Paul Jackson.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, look, I think they've seen an opportunity. The Ten Network's obviously been underperforming. There are strategies you can put in place to improve it. They've seen the opportunity. and they're going in. And I think with names like that, you know, to your point, you know, the credibility of both those names, Packer and Murdoch, you know, they've got a great track record, and you've got to say that you'd bet on them to probably, you know, pull 10 up and improve it. So it's got to be good news, and it's got to be exciting. It's also great seeing all the column inches. You know, everywhere you read all the business pages, and there's just a lot of stuff around it, which just makes it exciting, doesn't it?
And I suppose the other argument I'd make as well is that with the names Packer and Murdoch, it will probably instantly bring in advertising dollars that weren't there before. Certainly, you know, I've sort of made the case that Mitchell's, for instance, there are lots of personal affiliations with the Packer family, which immediately you could probably see 10, which has been underinvested in by Mitchell's in the past compared to others, would probably pick up. Do you think that's a sort of fair observation?
Not from my business, no. I mean, they'll have to perform to get the money, simple as that, as does every media owner. You know, I'm not going to give my clients' investment to anyone because of their name.
But if other people
want to do that, then that's kind of other people.
And do you see other people doing that?
I'm not sure I do at the moment because I think it's too early to tell. I think there's certainly been a history of agencies, you mentioned Mitchell's, where they overly invest in certain media relationships, whether that's for reasons that they handle the business or whether that's because they have historic relationships. You know, that they'll have good reasons for doing it, just as we have good reasons for doing it.
Well, that unfortunately is where we have to leave it for today. Thank you very much to my guest, Paul Robinson of Kids Co.
Thank you. Great pleasure being here. See you hopefully next time in maybe probably, I think, around the Astra Conference in March.
Another 6 months' time or so. And Toby Jenner of Mediacom.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks also to CBS for use of their studios. Production was by Georgina Pearson. That was the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle-pip.